The first thing, I've obviously not read the book as it's not out yet, but we will be selling some of your books at the break, so please, people do take your opportunity to buy some of Toby's books. But I was reading some of the advanced publicity, and I think Agatha Christie was mentioned in there, and I wonder if that's the sort of hyperactive publicist, or is that something that was deliberately in your mind when you were writing the book?
No, it was the hyperactive Maxim Jakubowski, who is the sort of saint of London crime publishing, and also he used to run the Murder One bookshop, if you remember that. It was down on Tottenham Court Road. It's swapped sides of the road, and then I think it has disappeared. He edits crime anthologies and things, and he was one of the people that I asked if the publishers could send it to. And with his vast knowledge, he's clearly picked out that Agatha Christie isn't probably my favourite crime writer. No, I'm not doing a damn. She is probably the writer I read for absolute relaxation pleasure, because I know that she's superb technically. She's never going to write a bad sentence. It's going to be a good mystery. It's going to have a solution that won't let me down. And that she did a number of books that did various things where, for example, a murder is announced, where you have the sort of conceit of how do you murder someone. If you told everyone in the village, someone will be killed in this place at this time. And I like her ways of doing things, where she does things incredibly sort of calculatingly, in a sense. And this book, it's not an attempt to do an Agatha Christie, although it tries to be a clean book, but it does have this thing about being narrated by two amateur sleuths, which is what it's also described as, two amateur sleuths rather than police people or anything, Skelton and Kimiko, who separately go after the reason for this heart being on the roofs of Borough Market. And the reason they go after it separately is because after they get back from dealing with the police, after the heart has been found, they split up, because Kimiko dumped Skelton for not being forceful enough and not being basically someone capable of spontaneity, like, hey, let's go get on the roofs of Borough Market to see if that really was a heart. So they diverge, but all the time throughout the novel they're sending those little kind of messages that exes send to one another, even though they're not meaning to. So that was, if he's picking anything up, it's that kind of formal idea in the novel. Have two investigators who are not speaking to one another, but who find out things that the other one could really, really use to solve, well, there's two crimes.
Great. I noticed another writer you've written about is J.G. Ballard, and that kind of, you sort of struck me in this part that you're reading, this idea of London as somewhere that kind of horrific things can happen and that are difficult to interpret. Was that something that sort of fed into this book?
No, I really wasn't thinking of Ballard. But it takes an effort not to think of Ballard. In my case, when you're writing about anything mechanical or probably that involves metal or hard forms of any sort, because he seems to own so much of those spaces where people are uncomfortable, you know, where as soon as you step off the sort of places where the consumers are meant to walk on their paths, and you go onto the airport, or you end up in the deserted swimming pool or the empty hotel sort of forecourt, you know, or behind the hotel with the bins, then you're in Ballard territory. And with this, I wasn't attempting to go for anything like the coldness he had, because this relationship is actually not one of those Ballard, a character called sort of Charles Williams finds a woman who has this kind of tempestuous affair with, which really doesn't matter at all. And that's always there. This was crucial that their relationship was very true.
Great, thanks. Have we got any questions from the audience?
ex students look shifty. But then they always did.
Was that the beginning of the novel that you read us?
That, yes.
And if so, did that come first or did the plot and the rest of the story? Because it's such a grabbing start to the book.
There were different starts to the book. One was a book called The Heart in my head, that fits in the alphabet sequence books. My books are being written in alphabetical order, so I've reached K. The idea for The Heart was about someone finding a heart, a fairly simple sort of idea. Then there was the idea of the roofs of Borough Market. I really wanted, I would go over them, you know, in the train, and I thought this is just fantastic for a film or something. How could this be used? And then I had the idea of the double investigation by a couple who've split up and sort of aren't talking at all. And when those three things came together, I had a very young, my first son was very young and I was bottle feeding him. And these ideas came together and I plotted the novel whilst bottle feeding him over the course of a couple of nights. Because he was a very slow feeder, and I could sit there, I mean, I'd sit there like this, and just kind of, all right, second back, all right, yes, denouement. And then I wrote it down, but I didn't get a chance to sort of sit down and start writing it. But there is a sentence in the Skelton's description of Kimiko, in the first paragraph, where he says her hair was like oil. Black oil flowing over a stone, and that I wrote in a notebook in something like 2000 because I knew that I would write about this Japanese woman, but she didn't have a name, she wasn't in a particular story. So there's all these little bits came from all over. So it didn't come fully formed, and I tried writing The Heart in a different form, it didn't work. The opening of that was a guy saying, I'd like to make clear at the very start that this was a real heart, not some kind of metaphorical thing. It was a real squishy human heart, but that didn't go anywhere.
Any more questions?
Did the alphabeticising idea come before or after Adventures in Capitalism? And have you ever?
You've asked me this before. You're just pressing me on it. It came before.
And have you ever regretted it?
Sometimes, very much so. Particularly when people ask me the reason and I've forgotten it. But mainly because there are difficult letters ahead. Second half of the alphabet is a lot more tricky. Q, not looking forward to it. X, Y, Z could get a bit sticky there. Xylophone. You know, people do suggest things to me, but no, and it has warped my view of the world so much that I think, how do other novelists cope without at least that structure? You know, well, my next novel is going to be, I don't know anything about it, it's just some kind of random novel that I'm going to have to think of. I think, well, at least I know the first letter of the title, and that's just it's like a little glimpse, just a little tiny glimpse into the future, and so I say it allows me to kind of structure my potential future, if only. But no, I did think about it partly because I used to work in a bookshop, and I'm slightly Asperger's, and I always was very, very worried about whether I should alphabetize the authors, you know, Kashu Ishiguro or whatever, alphabetically with their titles or chronologically. On a wet weekend in Wimbledon in Fielder's Bookshop, this was a big question for me. And I think I came down alphabetically because that satisfied my, you know, my Asperger's. But there were a few, and Kesu Ishiguro I mentioned, a few novelists who accidentally or by design had written their books in alphabetical order. And his first four or five books were in alphabetical order until he got too far in the alphabet and then had to kind of skip back. And of course, there's Sue Grafton, the crime writer who wrote A is for Alibi. You know. So it was sort of like that, that I knew that if a book begins with A, it's the start of the alphabet, and you could have an X1 BCD, and then that author would be perfect for bored bookshop workers. Little did I know that by the time I get to Z, bookshops may no longer exist. Or that when you go onto Amazon.com or whatever, it will automatically alphabetize everything. So there was trying to be helpful.
And that's what happens.
That's what
Dare I ask what happens when you get to Z plus one?
That's the other time I really regret doing it. because that's a long way away, and I'll be very lucky if I survive, write that many books. And the cheap answer is I'll have a holiday. And the non-cheap answer is I have an idea, but I'm clearly not going to tell any of you. I'm building up to Z, really. Z's the biggie, clearly.
Question back.
Yeah, I noticed, obviously, the character kind of described heightened sensibilities, which is Japanese and authentic, but it took me out of moment slightly because I had to do a quick mental conversion into V. Did you give that any thought, that as in, you know, should I go for authenticity or trying to keep people in the moment of the story?
With things like that, I think I made her do all her measurements in centimetres and him do all his in feet and inches. And it was one of those differences between them, which is the kind of thing that copy editors would pick up and say, you're being inconsistent here. And it's, one's a British guy, one's a Japanese woman, and that's how they think. Possibly, I'm glad you pointed out, I hadn't thought of it, that I was hoping that people would kind of skip past that pretty fast, and they'd be more concerned with what was going on. Maybe standing up here reading Memoirs of a Bald Accountant of 150 centimetres, it stuck out more than it should have done. But her voice, which I've sort of gone through that and edited it to make it slightly more direct with the action, is a bit stop-starty in a funny kind of way, and she doesn't say things conventionally. I cut the first paragraph, which said, she's written this in Japanese and it's been translated into English, but it has a different kind of texture. So things like that are meant to be slightly awkward. She phrases things slightly awkwardly, but says them better than conventional English. And I didn't want them, either of them as narrators, to be like really good at writing a thriller. So they sometimes, they're concentrating on the personal thing or some kind of something they've noticed or whatever, rather than kind of really ramming the action home. So there are just little catches, but maybe that screws it up. I don't know. It's a good question, though. Beware of using centimetres in your books.
That's one of the learning points tonight. There will be a short test later. Thanks so much, Toby, there's another question.
There was another question.
I had a question, which is, how do you judge when to break the rules of grammar? And the one, two, times that you think you need to break the rules tiny things.
There were.
I was one had a really hard judgment.
It really is, it's sentence by sentence, but I think about it a bit like the Dogma 95 film movement, where if you've seen Festen, which was one of the ones they made, they had certain rules about how they were going to make these films, and basically it was a way of taking power back from the technicians and giving it to the director and the actors. So the director could say, yeah, I really like that take for the acting, but the sky didn't match the sky in the previous shot, so it's getting darker, lighter and things. And also, very early on, you see the boom descend in one of the shots, and you see this fuzzy kind of thing. Now, obviously, if you do that in any film now, easy to do a digital fix on it, but it used to be something, if you couldn't afford to reshoot, you just have to let it happen. And if that happens in a really high-gloss film, which occasionally it does, like an hour in to a Bond or something, this fuzzy mic suddenly could have appears over Roger Moore's head. I'm not specifically, I can't think of a Bond film that was actually improved by the appearance of a mic. But if that happens consistently from page one of a book, if it happens consistently from minute one of a film, then it's accepted and it's not oh, this is an error, it's just part of the voice. So if you're nervous about it, that will probably show. If you think, you know, you're fine, then you will probably breeze through, because it can't, it just has to be come out of the sort of rhythm of the speaker and the way they think. But yes, she does do odd things with plurals and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay, well, thanks again for your reading. Another round of applause for Toby, please.